You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
We're really lucky to have Wayne here today. Some of you may be asking the question, what are we doing with an ethnomusicologist sitting here at a center that studies the internet? But if you were to have one ethnomusicologist sitting at the head of the table at the Berkman Center, this is the guy to have. Wayne has done really remarkable work looking at the question of how digital culture is changing musical culture, and specifically changing this sort of very nebulous notion of world music. And honestly, I'm so interested in what he has to say, I'm not going to say the 12 nice things I have to say about the man. You can read my blog. I love this guy. I think he does tremendous work, and I'm going to shut up and let him talk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you to you all. Thank you very much to Ethan and to Amr for... It's a thrill to be speaking in one of these, having watched many of them and attended a few in my time. So let's get right to it. What I'm talking about today is what I'm calling the unstable platforms and uneasy peers of Brave New World music. In a lot of ways, what some of the underlying issues of what I'll be talking about today have really been brought into sharp relief in just the last week, of course, around the commotion around WikiLeaks and the ways that what many people take to be quote-unquote public platforms are shown to be anything but necessarily public, or the ways that people see spaces for free speech not necessarily seeming so free. As Ethan posed it in his introduction to me, oftentimes there's a sort of feeling that, well, what can music tell us about this or that? What can music tell us about politics or about media? And I think it can tell us a great deal. In particular, a lot of what I've been looking at over the last few years, which is to say the way that sort of contemporary musical practices and musical culture routes its way and is routed through the World Wide Web, shows some of the fault lines in what we might think of as public culture as instantiated on the web. In lots of ways, we might hear some of these songs, see some of these dances as canaries in the coal mine, especially as they disappear before our eyes. If you look behind me here, I've got a screenshot that I took from a YouTube video because I couldn't assume it would remain up there. And what we see in some ways is the face of Brave New World Music, a face covered with a watermark produced because this video was made using unlicensed demo software, right? And it says, remove this thing in front of your face by paying for a license. And one of the things that I'm observing in this brave new world of music making, if you will, is how much it's marked by some of these issues, that the aesthetic qualities themselves seem to carry the traces of the technologies on which they're made. Now, on the one hand, what I'm going to be trying to show and what I've been bearing witness to in my blog and in my research is the incredibly productive powers that have been unleashed by the advent of digital tools, and in particular, professional-grade tools of production and the capacity to publish to a near-limitless audience. Even if you don't have to buy that software, right? Even if we're using a free, quote-unquote, free platform like YouTube, or if you're using demo software or pirated software and what have you. In a lot of ways, what I'm talking about is less a kind of brave new world music than the music of what we might hail as a brave new world with such oversharing young people in it. And in part, what this kind of watermark bears witness to is maybe a different set of priorities, that rather than posterity or polish, what we're instead seeing is an emphasis on participation, on immediacy, on immersion, on doing things in the moment without caring too much about how they sound or how they look. So this watermark, just to give you a bit more texture here, is it sort of riddles this video here called Marvel Inc. Jerkin in Hollywood. Let me explain a little bit. Jerkin is the name for a subgenre of hip-hop that emerged out of Los Angeles, especially through a few different high schools in Los Angeles in the last few years. Many of these crews, dance crews and production crews, take names from popular, you know, popular brands, whether of comic books or cartoons, Marvel Inc., Power Rangers, and so forth. And so that's one of the ways that, you know, we might even see Marvel Inc. as a way of kind of hacking the system, right? So these guys put up their video, they have a name like this, which can get serendipitous page views, but they also are careful to tag their video with not only their own names and important tags like Jerkin, Hollywood, but also with all of their sort of rival and compatriot crews, Audio Push, the Rangers, as well as rather unrelated things like the Dougie, which is the name of another dance, Digital Dripped, which is an online service where a lot of these kids upload their tracks and so forth. But in general, we see, you know, a somewhat savvy approach to this, despite that, you know, on the other hand, we see a lack of care for these kind of watermarks. Here, let's see some Jerkin moves as this kid dances around the demo watermark here. Scott, can't stop, I'm too busy on top. I'm like Kobe, you lame, just Rick Box. Yeah, and I ain't gotta re-up. I got colors, I'm just trying to hit my dream up. See us and your shit might freeze up. I'm sneezed up, please get up off these cashews. They probably won't match you. My fit mean and my swagger is mad rude. I'm that dude and we ain't gotta ask who. Look at him, you're probably won't have to. Notably, as you see, they're dancing in public places. Just as public as YouTube in their way. And they even here attribute the songs that they're dancing to in this video. So this is a sort of video promoting them as a dance crew. They have links going to the two sites other than these major sites like YouTube, where kids are posting new tracks and new videos and so forth. And most of these tracks are homemade. They're not commercially distributed. They're distributed free on things like digitaldrip.com. They're streamed on jerkinradio.com. And I don't want to deny that plenty of these kids have commercial aspirations, but I want to note that sort of first and foremost, they're entering into a kind of non-commercial circulation, and also a circulation that's primarily intended for their peers. I mean, their local peers, not just this sort of vaguer sense of peers that we talk about when we get into peer-to-peer technology. But of course, the other thing to bear in mind is that this stuff is posted to these sites which are public by default. So not only do their local high school friends get to see this, but we get to see it here at the Berkman Center in Cambridge. Another way that this kind of prioritization, if you will, of immediacy and participation gets registered is in the actual sound of the music. So sort of analog to the watermark, well, in this case, actually, what we see is the effect of an audio watermark. This is one of these songs, a song by a guy named Fly Kid called Buckle My Shoe, and this is a screenshot I took of the waveform, where you see every 15 seconds or so a dip in the audio, and I want to show you what that sounds like. So I typed in Fly Kid Buckle My Shoe in my history here, and I see that the video has disappeared. But we can actually find it elsewhere on Daily Motion. Of course, what that means is you guys first have to watch an ad. Now, this is part of it, right? I mean, these are our public platforms, but they're subsidized in various ways. So in order to get to this video, we're going to have to watch another 23 seconds of an ad of some sort. And yet, you know, again, as I'm saying, despite these sort of compromised qualities, you know, whether we're talking about being riddled by watermarks or pop-up ads, there the video is nonetheless, and in another 5 seconds, we'll get a chance to see and hear it. Now, there's not a lot to see.
AVS Media Demo.
That's the watermark. There's not a lot to see. It's just a static image, and underneath we get the
Hey girl, you can check my ego, and I stay fly like I'm a superhero, and my style code
AVS Media.
He's got good and in fact, that happens every 15 seconds in this track, and yet every instantiation of this track, including presumably the original one that was uploaded to Digital Dripped, has that in it, right? So the kid makes it He says, you know what, I'm just going to share my song regardless, and it goes out there. Now, you can search for AVS Media Demo, and you'll find people discussing on MySpace, how do I get rid of this? How do I fix this? It turns out, in this case, it's kind of a funny thing. It turns out, I think Audacity is a popular wave editing program. It's a free one. It's an open source one. But in order to render to MP3, you have to sort of download another component, and there's a way to do that in which you end up, instead of doing the free version, doing this paid version, which then if you don't pay for, you end up with a British robot interrupting every 15 seconds. So that's one way in which, on the one hand, we can bear witness to this sort of unhindered productivity, if you will, and yet another way in which maybe we can see it as somewhat compromised. Now, I want to tell another little story, again, based around Jerkin, which, you know, is not exactly exceptional in this way. We could point to lots of other examples, whether we're talking about subgenres and genres or particular dance moves. But Jerkin is a good one for a variety of reasons. Now, one of the best-known Jerkin tracks is a song called You're a Jerk by the New Boys. A little backstory on this song, they produced it themselves. They produced it using a software called Fruity Loops, or FL Studio, which is a very easily obtained program and easily mastered. It's pretty intuitive to use, but also it's increasingly easy to use because of how many people post how-to tutorials on YouTube. So when they wanted to make a track of their own, seeing that their high school friends were also involved in this Jerkin movement, what did they do? They went to YouTube and Googled, you know, how to make a hip-hop beat on Fruity Loops. Googled, searched. So they tell this story. We downloaded some packs, some presets, and we made our own song. What they then did, and this is a crucial part of the story, they uploaded the audio track to their MySpace page, and they circulated around their local friends and so forth, and they started to see that people liked the song. They liked the song enough that they started filming their own dance videos to it. And so they talk about going on YouTube and searching for You're a Jerk and New Boys and finding all these amazing instantiations where people were dancing to their song. So here are some examples. This is actually a sort of a next level. This is a bunch of examples of these videos stitched together by somebody. So these are all people who are dancing to You're a Jerk by the New Boys. And what you'll see here is the distinctive Jerkin style, which includes a patented move called the reject, which is described oftentimes as the running man in reverse. I'll show you what that
jerk.
I know.
You're a jerk. You're a jerk.
I know.
You're a jerk. You're a jerk.
I know.
You're a jerk.
The running man in reverse.
You're a jerk. You're a jerk. You're a jerk. You're a jerk.
Now, one interesting and distinctive thing about Jerkin, though, is that there is sort of pro-geek discourse running through it. They talk about getting geeked out, and there's a sort of embrace of technology.
I'm so cocky with it. Got my eyes shut, closed like Rocky hit it. Got the girl on my swag, she loving them jerking songs like a new iPod. Just touch it and turn her on, and when the bass start beating and the waist I'm beating.
Anyway, it goes on and on and on like this. We could watch dozens of them. At least we could have watched dozens of them at one time. What happened is this song became so popular, precisely because of this practice, that the New Boys got signed. They got a record deal, and they got to produce a very slick version of their video, an official version, which looks more like this. So again, you get the prominent, you know, placement of certain mobile devices and so forth. You know, technology has shot through this thing. And
so
although
Sidekick didn't actually pay for this.
This is the same original recording, as far as I know. It may have been remastered, but this became a nationwide hit. It was played on urban radio. The official video made it onto all the video stations and so forth. And these guys, they made a little career for themselves, at least for a year or so. I'm not familiar. I'm not really sure what's going on with them at the moment. But that's a classic music industry problem. Now, one thing I'm going to have to bracket here, although it's very fascinating and it's part of the story, is that these Jerkin kids, as you're seeing, are really foregrounding their embrace of technology, the fact that they like to geek out, and they're also using all these other symbols sort of skateboard culture, of popular culture. They're wearing skinny jeans and so forth, and the way that they project this sort of alternative young black maleness, but also femaleness, has instigated no small number of arguments about, you know, whether they're violating sort of traditional black masculinity and that sort of thing. And so, you know, that's sort of another part of the story, having to do again with the question of a public conversation and how it gets staged around something as simple as a dance video. Now, once this happened, and once the New Boys song got entered into, you know, the official database of official, you know, officially licensed songs, that meant that YouTube's audio crawling worm, or whatever it is, with their algorithm for detecting audio, started to find these videos, these unauthorized ones, and they started disappearing. I started going back looking for them and noted that, oh, this one's not there anymore, and this one's not there anymore, and, oh, I can still find this one where the audio is not as audible because it's coming from an on-screen source. But if you go to something like Action Figures, You're a Jerk, which was the first clip that we saw in that montage video, it's now, and here's this kid again, it now sounds like this. Juncture here has people asking lots of inappropriate YouTube questions like, LOL, this is how Africans jerk, right? Everybody hears this sort of new age tribal music as African and makes lots of jokes about it. But, you know, it's a great example, again, of, you know, the weird ways that that this youth culture ends up getting compromised in a variety of ways. Now, of course, they're still making the best of it. They're helping Aalborg Fantasy soundtracks to sell Piper at the Gates, and they put all these other little clicks in so you can go find their newer videos and that sort of thing.
Who put that new music in?
They chose to do that. So in cases where you're using unauthorized music and YouTube finds it, they'll send you a notice and say, look, you can't use this audio. You can either choose to mute it and have a silent video, or you can sub in any one of these things that are available for this kind of use. And so they decided, okay, sure, I'll pick this one. I mean, I haven't talked to them. I'd love to interview them sometime and ask them about this. But they decided, all right, we're going to keep the dance video up, and it'll have this weird soundtrack instead.
What role did the record company play in that particular set of choice tree?
That's a very good question, and one that I'm not exactly sure about. My impression is that this happens a lot more automatically than conscientiously, right? That once that song becomes part of this database,
so Google and YouTube detects that this is copyrighted music,
right?
Sets off a flag that gives you these choices, and that is what follows,
right?
Where ideally the record company would have maybe inserted the stuff with that you saw the other video, where they watermark it or otherwise deface it in a way that allows you to hear the music, but not necessarily to copy.
Right, or actually now it's possible that, I mean, there's no reason that this shouldn't lead to, you know, buy the New Boys song on Amazon, right? There's no reason that audio shouldn't have been able to stay and serve as the promotional vehicle that it was from the beginning, but a more directly commercial one. So yeah.
It's my understanding that the record companies can choose to run ads over the videos instead of taking them down if they want.
Mm-hmm.
So not clear why they didn't do it.
There were multiple choices. They could run ads and collect revenue. They could have it taken down. There was basically several choices.
It's also right. Like whatever small record label signed the New Boys, they're part of this media conglomerate, and that media conglomerate decides what the YouTube policy is.
Right.
So even if the new whoever signed the New Boys.
Yeah, or the New Boys themselves. Yeah, they don't necessarily have a say in it. Right. It becomes part of this larger, somewhat automated structure. Yes.
Is the initial defacing that you described of the demo version, either for the audio or the video, perhaps something that the record label is happy with because it allows the New Boys to have their thing still up there, mm-hmm. but to have it not be a quality that somebody who really wants it would then still have to pay for the real version?
Right. That's a possibility too, and some people have embraced that as a business model. So
I think my understanding is that the affirmative effort by YouTube and Google to go out and find something and take it down
is triggered after someone has asked them to take one instance of the content down, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think there's a lot of automated stuff happening now.
YouTube has put into play a new system.
There's flag
where you register your audio content with them. YouTube then automatically crawls the audio of all videos existing on the site, and as they're uploaded, if it finds a match between something registered in its audio library and the audio on the track, even if it's being played in the background,
does a Shazam,
you get an automated takedown notice. It's an extremely well-developed
system. But only if the content owner starts a process.
It basically triggers and says at that point, tell us, you know, what the content owner then decided to do with that.
But I
don't think it has to be an external complaint. It's basically a pre-registered, we're in the database, and if you trigger something that's in the database,
But the content owner has indicated its preference.
Right. The content owner is, you know, registering hundreds of thousands of tracks.
Right.
Is there an option for the content owner to say, rather than taking it down, let it play and put up an...
The vast majority of content owners decide to do that instead of taking it down.
So hopefully this gives you one sense of the ways in which these platforms are unstable and end up producing sort of distortionary effects, even if we also see ways that this sort of youthful creativity is in its own way irrepressible. Another example of this at a sort of slightly different level of remove, and I guess I'll go to my blog for a second to take a look at this screenshot, has to do with the way that entire sites like YouTube or like iMeme or, for instance, Jamglue can themselves disappear, right? So we can talk about individual instantiations of audio or video or so forth. But here's a screenshot that I took a few months ago, right before Jamglue shut down. Now, Jamglue was sort of like YouTube in that you could upload your own content to it. It was a little bit more like iMeme in that it was directed toward audio. So the idea would be you could upload your own tracks, but you could also mix tracks on there. One of the interesting things about Jamglue is that it allowed users to, online, mix and match tracks, make a remix, that kind of thing. So if you did a search for Jerkin just before Jamglue closed, you could find 775 matches for mixes, which indicates that these were mixed online in Jamglue, and you could find 812 matches for tracks, most of them sort of generic and clearly self-produced things. Now, overnight, more or less, Jamglue disappeared, and with it, all of these tracks, as well as all the different connections. If you went to any of these individual profiles, as on YouTube, you could see how they're networked with other friends, other peers, and so forth. And so this is another way in which the platforms themselves can be unstable, at times just completely disappearing. So that's another side of the story. Now, to get briefly to the question of uneasy peers, I've noted that in lots of ways these are things that are being shared immediately for one's actual local group. And a lot of the really wonderful research on quote unquote digital youth culture in the last few years has been good about noting that it's not about a kind of participation in this vague digital world, but it's about using these digital tools to communicate with actual friends, actual local friends, real people, and so forth. But of course, you know, one side effect of that is that the stuff can circulate much more widely. And so we find ways in which people in other places of the world and other kinds of peers pick up on it. One example being this video that I also found on YouTube, made in Panama. And as you'll see, it bears a striking resemblance to the official New Boys video that we watched a minute ago. Striking insofar as it actually borrows a lot of the imagery, although then imposes its own versions as well. El Paso del Jerk, the jerk step, right? The jerk dance. Yeah. You're a jerk. We see a fairly close emulation of the video. In a different setting. And we see the ways in which these Panamanian kids are inserting themselves into a global mainstream and saying, look, here we are, we're fluent in the latest, greatest styles. Right. So he's using the same underlying instrumental as the New Boys song. He's recording a new rap over it. that nods to it in lots of ways. And I'll show you one more other quick example. Here's another sort of another downstream use, if you will. This is coming out of the Dominican Republic, and it also samples the New Boys song, but it also puts those samples alongside a whole bunch of other samples coming out of reggaeton, Jamaican reggae, Puerto Rican music, and so forth, and creating something that they're calling jerkbo. So jerkin mixed with dembo, which is a name given to a Jamaican rhythm very popular in the Latino world. Again.
Mami, déjame mamarte el culo. Mami, déjame mamarte el culo. Mami, déjame mamarte el culo. Mamarte el culo, mamarte el culo. Yaba, 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 yaba tú. Yaba, 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 yaba tú. Yaba, 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 yaba tú. El huevo se me pone como el bajo de los cú. Yaba, 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 yaba tú. Yaba, yaba, yaba.
You can also find other instantiations of this very video. If you were to search for Yaba Dabba Doo or Jerkbo, you can find Dominican kids dancing on the street of New York, streets of New York similarly, and that sort of thing. So, and something like this actually notably does not get pulled down so easily automatically from YouTube, in part because the samples are much more integrated into a sort of larger audio texture that the algorithm fails to detect. And lots of people have done experiments. Well, how can I shift the audio around enough to make it undetectable? That's not what is going on here. And rather, this You're a Jerk song is just entering into a more long-standing cultural practice, which in fact predates the advent of the social web. Although it's always been digital, of course, this kind of cut and paste remixing. I wouldn't argue that these are actually the uneasy peers, though. These are another set of peers. They're not the direct local peers, but they are a way in which we see this music entering into the world, and in fact being a kind of new world music, or at least the music of a brave new world in certain ways. We also see it, though, become a kind of world music when it circulates to other spots and to different kinds of peers. Here's a blog written by a peer of mine, a guy based in Chicago who calls himself Dave Quam. And his blog, as you can see, if we look at the tags over here, is devoted to really wide array of local dance genres from around the world, bubbling from the Netherlands, cumbia from Latin America, Jamaican dance hall, Chicago footwork, Chicago ghetto house, jerkin, Angolan kuduro, and so on and so on and so on. And you see here a post about the way that these jerkin tracks were circulating. So here he's saying, look, here's a Chicago kid freestyling over the You're a Jerk track. And he notes that, we also recently saw an example of, that's pointing to my blog. So I'm very much sort of embedded in this whole world. And part of doing that was a way of trying to bring a kind of critical take to things. But also Nigeria, he points to another blog here where somebody said, of course, punning on Jamaican jerk and other connotations. Somebody had found, look, here's somebody doing it in Panama, here's somebody freestyling over in Nigeria. We bear witness to the ways that this is just part of remix culture writ large, that has become a kind of global dominant for creativity, especially among young people, but not exclusive to young people. And so there are ways in which this stuff starts to circulate to other places, like this blog, also run by some friends, called Ghetto Bassquake. Now, it doesn't necessarily circulate as world music. I've been using that term in some ways as a critique. More often than not, it might circulate as global bass music or sometimes as global ghetto tech. And in that way, I start to see a certain uneasiness insofar as what can represent interesting moments of engagement, right? Oh, look, they're doing this in Panama. Why are they doing this in Panama? Let's figure out sort of what's going on with that local historical context, which does happen in some cases. In other cases, what we get instead is a blog that's more concerned with a sort of fashionability of these things, and that works through these local genres in a sort of flavor of the month way. So, you know, at one point you might be interested in funk carioca from Rio de Janeiro. In the next moment, Angolan Kuduro, in the next moment Mexican Cumbia, and so on and so forth. And so as much as sometimes these people can serve the role that I think that Ethan looks a lot at in his work of being a kind of bridge figure or a bridge blogger, those opportunities to actually create cultural bridges and to create sort of moments of translation and collaboration don't always happen. They do sometimes, though. But that's one of the reasons that I bring in this term world music, is that on the one hand, what we see is a kind of reimagining of what the world of music is all about. It's not so much about the West and the rest anymore. It's not so much about the global North and the global South, but something like Jerkin from Los Angeles can circulate right alongside music from Panama, music from Nigeria, and so forth. On the other hand, you know, there are some ways in which the way that world music sets up a kind of exoticized picture of the world also carries forward into this, especially with regard to the way that the ghetto plays a kind of rhetorical role in it. There's a lot to say, and I can sort of keep going, but I'm as eager to hear from you guys as to let you hear from me. I would just say, sort of in conclusion, you know, we're seeing a lot of the same problems around the platforms that we increasingly come to think of as public, as part of our public culture. And I really love the way that on the one hand, some of these musical phenomena can show us how people work through and around those things, and on the other hand, how we might also use it to see some of the limitations, some of the constraints, and to think about whether there might be other ways to go about it. I think that as much as it's important to emphasize things like new media literacies and so forth, and we can see kids employing these literacies, there are also ways in which those literacies only go so far, and maybe there are other more design or architecture related questions that we have to think about. So I'll leave it there, but thank you very much.
So the floor is open for questions or for anyone who wants to show off their jerk moves. I know, Joseph, you wanted to dance first before a little bit off.
Okay, so thank you, Wayne. That was very interesting. I wanted to challenge your claim that the display of the cell phones are necessarily a display of sort of technical proficiency or new media literacy. I think it could equally be just some sort of status display. Look at this fancy gadget I have. Or a display of socialness, like I have lots of friends and I have to communicate with mm-hmm. them. So could you explain your interpretation a bit further?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't exclude those other ones. I mean, I think those are part of it too, as well as just being a conspicuous consumer, right? The status thing, as you note. And yet there are other ways in which I think we can see something like Dayglo skinny jeans or like having a sidekick as another kind of platform, another way of sort of amplifying your voice, of putting it out there. I don't mean to read it too optimistically as a kind of savvy, but there is a way in which these kids are foregrounding it in what they do. And I do feel like we can see and hear other examples that perhaps are demonstrating a certain savviness, you know, in terms of the way that they're editing these things together and that kind of thing. So there are surface elements here, to be sure, though.
Every week on Digital Drift, you'll see a track that mentions Twitter or Facebook or getting text messages or, you know, whatever. Like, there are Twitter jerking tracks, which implies that people are...
Yeah, no, I mean, these technologies, they occupy a sort of important thematic role, even in the songs themselves, not just in the video.
But the reason I ask is because there's a common myth of mm-hmm. Proficiency among young people,
yes.
And they can certainly use technology, but that doesn't mean they're savvy or critical or really proficient at the technical aspects.
Absolutely, no, and I appreciate you sort of drawing that out, because that's one of the things I was sort of trying to hint at the end with the question of literacies, and that there are certain kinds of literacies that I think are very clearly coming through here, and there are other ways in which maybe there's a marked lack of savviness, and I certainly don't mean to generalize across a generation, as people are want to do. Yeah.
There's so many free audio tools, you know, including LAME and others and mm-hmm. Audacity. It makes me wonder if choosing the one that inserts the fixed rhythm of someone complaining about buying that might not be a deliberate choice.
Might not be a deliberate choice.
Might be a deliberate choice.
Yeah.
As because it's easy to get around if you want it.
Right.
And once somebody, or even on the videos, once somebody uses the tool that puts up the thing, that becomes the way to do it, not because there aren't other choices, but because that becomes the style.
Yeah. No, that's true. And that's an interesting thesis. I mean, I don't see or hear people bragging about their you know, watermarks as much as they brag about some of the other things. So I
don't know. It's just audio is really easy to get.
Audio is really easy to do. And I mean, that's the thing. Lame Encoder is an easy freeway to bounce down your MP3s out of audio, out of Audacity. And yet some people seem to have mistakenly gotten a different encoder that does this to them. But yeah.
And there was the phenomenon where the logos and the caps on videos 20 years ago were smudged out, right?
Right.
I don't know if this is just
well, that had resurfacing of that. The blurring of commercial logos had more to do with stations like MTV not wanting to give free advertising to people. Whereas as far as I can tell, is not an intentional thing ever. It just has more to do with not caring enough to try to remove it and just saying, okay, here's my thing.
But you can imagine at some point, not caring becomes an actual deliberate decision to include it as part of the music.
That's true. And I think it's also, we might even imagine that that's especially true for people who are savvy enough about their commercial aspirations and don't want to leak, so to speak, you know, the best version, the best quality versions of what they're doing. Chicago Juke is an interesting example of this, insofar as a lot of those guys, the producers that making that stuff, were using streaming services like iMeme, like YouTube, and it was notoriously hard to get a copy of a good MP3 of that music. And in the last year, in part because of these unanticipated and maybe uneasy circulations, a record label in London, where there's been a lot of interest in Chicago Juke, has approached these artists and made licensing deals with them, and has released, you know, the only high quality versions of these songs. They're not necessarily MP3s available. So even if it wasn't a deliberate strategy in that sense, it worked, and people might then pick up on that as a tactic.
I happen to know that David's new reggaeton album actually is filled with a lot of these watermarks, just to make sure that everyone knows that he's.
You know, I'm thinking about Rice doing "Come Out to Shoot Him." I mean, you can play with this stuff and make.
Let's take a question here, please.
As recently as probably five years ago, it was pretty much impossible to have access to this kind of thing outside of a very underground tape trading network and video trading network, which I'm sure you were a part of.
Sure.
So with this kind of accessibility, how have you found these movements affected by, is it like there's no more underground or margin anymore? Because some of these videos have over 1 million views already.
That's right. Yeah, well, I think that those boundaries between underground and mainstream, to the extent that they ever existed, have, of course, been increasingly blurred by the degree to which the web has become a broadcast medium. I wouldn't say that there's no, rather than there being no more underground, it's just that the access to them is a little easier than it was before. But I think it's also important to note that some of these practices you allude to before, you know, trading around tapes and so forth, provide a sort of long-standing cultural foundation for the practices that they tend to get, that tend to get hailed as kind of new, you know, in this digital sort of world. Less than being new, we're just seeing sort of long-standing approaches being easier to do. I do think that it does introduce interest, you know, sort of new ideas about what
you
could
have swag.
to the extent that a phenomenon like this can then bubble up into the mainstream, is that that's one side of it. On the other hand, I think there are lots of scenes like this that are sort of self-sustaining without ever getting that far.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Are there some people who, in your research, you find that are just completely avoiding or disavowing the public platforms because they just want to keep their work outside of that public access platform?
Well, I'm sure there are. I haven't encountered as much of that myself. Although, you know, I think that more often than not, it's less a strategy to, okay, I want anybody in the world to see this than, you know, I want my friends to see this, but it just so happens that everybody in the world can see it. That's sort of more how I'm seeing it play out. Mm-hmm. Dave?
So let me read from the record, from the transcript, which I certainly got a little bit wrong. You say, I believe, it's important, this is not a hostile question, by the way, even though I'm setting it up that way. It's important to teach new media literacies, but they only go so far. Maybe there are more design and architectural issues to think about.
Yeah.
So what are those design and architectural issues that you've been thinking about?
Right. Well, I mean, they have to do with these so-called platforms that a lot of us have naturalized as being public, but which we see are subject to all kinds of attack and capture and disappearance and so forth. I guess.
So what's an alternative?
What's an alternative? Yeah. Right. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, they exist here and there, right? Project VRM and other things where people are trying to store more things on their own servers and so forth. I mean, one thing that sort of at the next level is that this blog, Ghetto Basequake, is now located at ghettobasequake.com. It used to be located at ghettobasequake.blogspot.com. But what happened is that a lot of music blogs like this suddenly got hit by a lot of takedown notices from Google. You know, I mean, you're up on this big platform which allows you to amplify your voice and so forth, but it also comes with these other things. And so last spring, after the so-called music blogicide 2010, a number of these blogs got their own, they switched to WordPress software, they set up their own servers, and now they're hosting their own things. Now, That's the blog side of things, and it's much easier to sort of do that than to try to set up your own YouTube. I mean, I don't know what it would look like exactly, but I definitely think some alternatives, you know, would be useful, where you can store your own video so that you have so that the process of taking it down or making it disappear is less automatic, and gives you a chance to actually assert your fair use rights. Increasingly, so many of these productions are based in cut and paste, you know, sort of procedures, that copyright becomes the way that they're taken down. So and yet we're not able to really see people mount a really good fair use defense because the whole process happens in an automated kind of fashion. Yeah,
I've got two questions here. I want to make sure that I get the ones in the back channel as well. So one in the back channel was asking you if you would look at the distinction between the world music term and the ethnomusicology term in sort of light of what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, neither of those is a term, neither of those terms do I like, especially. I should say that I'm one of many ethnomusicologists who find that term a little bit odd at this point, and one that is misleading in lots of ways. I mean, it comes out of a history where a certain group of musicologists and also of anthropologists working in music decided that the term musicology wasn't really fitting for what they were doing, and that musicology tended to describe the study of, you know, the Western art music tradition, and they wanted to bring methods like ethnography into it. So ethnomusicology was proposed as a way of foregrounding sort of anthropological, ethnographic methods and so forth. I do find that it tends to, you know, suggest that we all study ethnic music or something like that. I mean, we either do or we don't. Either all music is ethnic or it's not, I think, in a certain sense. And world music, too, sets up this kind of weird opposition between, well, the world out there and whoever we might be, which is usually an unmarked Western consumer, right? And so there's a sort of West-Rest, North-South thing that gets set up in that, which I like. To me, I sort of see and hear that being destabilized as the world increasingly comes online. Now, I don't want to be too triumphalist about that, in that, you know, we're still looking at a world that is not all that wired. You know, there are interesting ways in which it's getting more and more wired, but we also do see kids in Mexico or in Nigeria or in inner city Chicago who are getting access and being able to sort of project their voices in a way that is new. That, you know, previously we would need either a record label or a sort of Western pop star like a Paul Simon or a David Byrne or so forth to kind of broker those sounds to us. So we've seen that a lot of those intermediaries have kind of slipped away. And yet I still want to use the term world music in part, you know, because I also see certain legacies of those kinds of representations, especially in the blog world, but also because I do want to try to position it as a new kind of world culture, as something that is truly global in its way.
Friend from Brad Pick.
I know that you started doing this research about platforms after the collapse of iMeme, RIP. But, you know, watching it, sort of this whole world of jerk music and other underground hip-hop, dance, whatever you want to call it, how have they, like, what have you learned from watching them recolonize the internet, you know, after one of their beloved institutions has fallen? Like, what pushes them to certain platforms, and what do you see as being done differently?
Right. Well, I'm not sure that I'm seeing much done differently. As far as I can tell, when something like iMeme collapses or Jamglue shuts down, people just move on. You know, they move on to whatever else it might be. YouTube, you know, is still going strong. Or they'll you know, embrace other tools like Twitter to do different sorts of things. But again, it seems to be a kind of tactical approach. Just like people are willing to accept audio or video watermarks, people are also willing to accept a certain kind of ephemerality for what they're doing. And that's why, again, it makes me think that in a certain sense, what we're seeing, what we're bearing witness to here, for all the problems, is a kind of return to music as social life, music as process, as participation. It's less about the sort of commodity form. In that way, I think what's going on here does resonate with a lot of recent work on the wealth of networks, right? Yochai's work, where he does sort of look at the cut and paste approach as being a kind of return to folk methods. I don't mean to necessarily romanticize it like that, but you know, I think again, as far as I can tell, I'm not seeing people really adapt too much. It's just more about, well, okay, I had my iMeme account and now that's gone. You know, I've still got my YouTube account, and you know, there are these other sites that I use as well. So I haven't observed anything too coherent as far as the response to that. Just a sort of, you know, improvisation, more or less.
I'm going to keep queuing questions. So I'm going to go here first, then online, and then I'll go to the other folks in the room. So let's go here first.
To keep pushing that, do you think that there's a new kind of underground forming, not necessarily kind of mainstream versus underground, but mainstream platforms versus underground platforms? Because when the example that you pretty much gave to answer the question was the difference between YouTube and Dailymotion. But I wonder if there are even more unknown platforms that especially kids in other countries are using, or non-English or non-American platforms, right, that are becoming popular.
Yes. Oh, sure. And, you know, in a certain sense, while YouTube is really big, depending on where in the world we're looking, there are different dominant platforms, right? So like Dailymotion, especially in the Francophone world, or there's a site called Skyrock that's also very popular among French youth who use it to post MP3s or to do status updates and that kind of thing. In Latin America, Fotolog is a popular way to maintain a certain part of your sort of social profile. But also, you know, audio, sort of digital audio lockers, things like Foreshared. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Or, you know, of course, people, still part of this whole tactical approach is that people use things like Mediafire, RapidShare, and that kind of thing. So there are those ways in which, again, it remains ephemeral, and yet it routes itself around certain problems. And then, of course, there are sort of more darknet spaces where people are also doing other kinds of exchange. But I can't name any of those places.
Does that actually affect the cultural practices for youth, though? Or are they constantly just jumping from platform to platform?
That's a good question. I mean, for me, I want a little bit more sustained ethnographic analysis of all of this. A lot of what I'm doing here is pretty armchair. I mean, you can do a lot from the armchair now with the internet. But yeah, I mean, I see a lot of people sort of moving on to the next thing. But I think there's some important research to be done there on some of these possible other paths people are taking.
One remarkable thing with Fotolog, if you're in Latin American cities nowadays, you'll often see on a well-done piece of graffiti, something more than just a simple tag, but someone's, you know, really large invested mural, their Fotolog URL to make sure you can go and see the documentation of this piece and the rest of their work. And in some cases, you'll actually find, you know, essentially directions to see the rest of their oeuvre within the given neighborhood.
Should the record labels pay for your consulting services?
Mine?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure what's going to save the record labels exactly. I mean, I think that the record labels, I assume you mean the big three or four, I mean, they would do well to see the way that something like You're a Jerk emerges out of this kind of peer participatory culture and find a way to more gently monetize that than to, you know, to sort of shut it down is the way that they do.
But you're not seeing them reacting like this.
Not seeing a reaction?
Yeah, among the record labels, not necessarily the big three, but just any of them.
Well, I mean, certainly a lot of smaller record labels invite this sort of thing. And the bigger record labels, they have a sort of left-hand, right-hand thing where they shut them down on the one hand and then they leak them out on the other, right? And so, you know, we can observe on lots of different levels people seeing what's going on and trying to find ways to work with it. But definitely, you know, a lot of these blogs, in fact, have now set up their own record labels. You see right here at the top, debut single out now. So the Ghetto Bass Quake record label has emerged from them cultivating a little audience with their blog and seeing that they can at least make some marginal digital sales. Now, at the same time that they allow you to click through, I don't know exactly what they're using to buy. You know, there are lots of sites now like Bandcamp and so forth that allow people to do digital downloads and sell them themselves in a way that's really convenient for a lot of artists and small labels. But they'll also do things like, you know, email all of their blog friends to and send them the tracks for free and try to get them sort of circulating that way as well. So, I mean, we're not seeing anything, again, sort of so coherent in terms of approach or policy, but a lot of people experimenting in lots of different ways. And in part because I'm a blogger who writes about music, I get a lot of promos sent to me, and I've noticed actually increasingly that rather than people sending me full MP3s or, you know, zip files of the music, that now I'm getting directed to streaming sites. And so people are sort of also saying, well, you know, we still want to invite this sort of unpaid blog labor to help us circulate our wares, but we don't necessarily want it to leak out that way, as an MP3. So
let me go online real quick for a couple of questions, then I'll get to you, Charlie. One question that was put up was whether you're documenting sort of a youth culture and remix coming into spaces like YouTube and also into Twitter. Someone wants to know whether we've seen it in Second Life, and further, whether we've seen Machinima coming in to make this.
Interesting. Well, yeah, no, I think that all of these various virtual spaces provide different kinds of platforms for doing this. I haven't been in Second Life for a little while, so I can't testify to that exactly. What's that?
You and what army?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, I mean, I think to some extent, these spaces can be niche spaces, right? On the other hand, you know, the bigger they are, the more impact they have. So probably some of the other kinds of virtual worlds where there's maybe a little more activity, you might find some of this happening.
So an encouragement for those of you who really want to stay underground, perhaps Second Life.
That's the place to have your ring. Yeah.
Another sort of, this is a particularly targeted question here. What is the researcher's responsibility to the artist if the artist doesn't include any copyright statement? What are the ethics of using the content in music videos for ethnographic study without informing the informant?
You mean that I'm that I may be that in calling attention to a particular production and talking about what it's sampling, that I'm giving away the fact that they're sampling? Is that the
I
would say that, you know, anything I'm talking about, I have fair use rights to talk about in this educational context. Now, I should say that my own research comes out of being very interested in sample-based hip-hop and in the way that copyright litigation created legal and aesthetic constraints for producers. In my master's thesis, which was about sample-based production and the litigation around it, I actually refused to divulge what was being sampled. I would note, here's a song where there's an audible sample and it's been chopped up and rearranged in this way, and I'm going to break basic research protocol by not making this source available to my peers to check out. And that was, you know, that was a sort of ethical question, a sort of problem I had to come around to. These days, I would say I'm a little bit more cavalier in saying what this thing is, because I'm a little bit more interested in showing how widespread a cultural practice this is. And, you know, if we want to talk about something like the Dembo sample, which is a really fascinating and long story that we can't go into right now, I mean, for somebody to sue over that, you'd have to bring thousands and thousands of people into the case. So it might actually prove interesting.
The one place where I think that question might have some standing is essentially you were saying early on that part of what's going on is that people may be looking for sort of private culture in a public space, which, as you correctly identify, is actually a private corporate space. Mm-hmm. But if you sort of try to carve out the private space by saying, this is for me and my friends, yeah, we're doing it on YouTube, but since you don't know about it, it functions as private. Is there any concern with you know, it's one thing when you have the 1.5 million viewers on The Jerk on some of this stuff, you know, it's a few hundred, a few thousand.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a worry at that point that you're essentially studying and reporting on informants who haven't decided to inform?
Sure. Yeah. No, of course there is. And this is always very tricky stuff, and I don't know how it would go with an institutional review board or that sort of thing, right? But, yeah.
The IRB rarely watches our webcast, by the way, so I wouldn't worry too much about it. So.
No, I mean, it is tricky, and, you know, being blogging about it and embedding these videos on my blog, of course, brings a certain kind of audience to it that may be uninvited, that may be an uneasy sort of relationship, and, you know, I'm always thinking about these things.
Charlie?
Wayne, I was wondering whether you consider this story, this New Boys story, to be a success story for them and for the label that signed them.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, where do you... Where are the bodies buried? What's the harms? What?
Well, it's a little hard to say. I mean, it's a success story insofar as they've had two big hits, you know, hits that have sold hundreds of thousands of copies and that have probably made them a fair amount of money and have enabled them to tour and all that kind of thing. I mean, we saw some of the casualties, which are some of the very videos that helped elevate them to where they are, disappearing. And to what extent they're... I was about to bring up the question of chilling effects, and what's actually interesting about a lot of this is, while I did observe chilling effects with regard to sample-based hip-hop in the 1990s, I don't see any chilling effects in this stuff. I just see kids doing it again. You know, I mean, the video disappears, and, oh well, that was last week anyway, you know? On the other hand, you know, there was this article in the New York Times to show you how big Jerkin got. It got its fashion and style piece, and it begins with this phrase, think globally, act virally, which I don't think is what... I mean, these kids may be acting virally, whatever that means, although I have problems with the whole viral concept, but they're not thinking globally. They're thinking locally. It does happen that their stuff traveled globally. But one of the sort of conspicuous things about this article now is that it notes, not too far down, that Warner Brothers, Asylum, and Interscope were among those that quickly signed Jerk and Cruise, The Bangs, The Cold Flames, The Rejects, and Audio Push. I've heard nothing from these groups since. It's like they just disappeared, and once they could no longer participate as... And that, now, I want to say I haven't necessarily looked for it, but it seems like this took all the air out of the Jerkin scene, and I've yet to see any officially released material by these groups. And so there is a way, if we're not measuring it in terms of commercial viability, but just the sort of cultural vibrancy, something happened there. And I do think that this is part of that picture. It's also that, you know, kids get bored and want to move on to the next thing, but... as far as I can tell, you know, a lot of people talk about convergence culture and how we can see a convergence or sort of a rapprochement in certain ways between the commercial apparatus and the sort of more non-commercial participatory side of things. I think we can also see ways in which those convergences are not always productive.
But a success for the label that signed them, mm-hmm. even though not a success for Warner Brothers and Interscope, who are trying to sign copycats.
Oh, you mean the smaller label that signed them? Because New Boys, they were signed by... I mean, eventually they're being distributed by one of these major labels. Uh-huh. That's just how it works.
They're making new songs, but they're all traditional hip-hop songs.
Right, yeah, their album was not really marked as a Jerkin-style album. Their first hit was, because that was their hit, that was their song. The other things they put out were a bit more, sort of more, I don't know, traditional run-of-the-mill right now, and they had one other radio hit along those lines, but I haven't heard anything from them since, and I haven't heard any rumblings about what they're doing next or that sort of thing yet either, and there certainly haven't been any New York Times follow-ups about it. I guess it's just not so fashionable.
I want to come back to something you said at the end of your talk, where you basically said we may be beyond the sort of world music paradigm of us and everybody else, or global north and global south, but I actually want to then sort of go back through the videos you have here, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were talking, we did a Radio Berkman segment before, and I was bringing in a frame that I've been finding very helpful lately that I'm stealing from Pippin Norris, which is sort of saying that there's at least four things that happen when cultures hit one another. One tends to dominate the other. That's the sort of, you know, McDonald's takes over local food culture. There's the jihadist rejection, you know, oh my God, I've seen your culture, now I, you know, declare war on you. There's the curry infusion reaction, let's put it together and let's see what happens from it. And then there's the nice culture you've got, thanks very much, I'm going to proceed with my own. HIPAA argues that generally four is what happened. We were sort of riffing on the radio and suggesting that this is a nice example of three. This is the curry, this is the fusion.
Yes.
At the same time, you know, he's wearing a Phillies cap. I've seen Yankees caps in every one of these videos. Right. I love New York.
Fat Farm t-shirts. Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, isn't what's going on essentially our Panamanian friends, our Dominican friends, and our Nigerian friends declaring we are as LA or as New York as everybody else? I mean, to me, the question becomes not when Panamanian versions of jerk come back into jerk culture, it's when cumbia, you know, starts filling, you know, New York dance floors, and not sort of with the hipsters reading these blogs, but actually, so
cumbia does fill New York dance floors in Mexican parts of New York and so forth, right?
So the question becomes, I mean, obviously there's a repeat here where this comes back into the Dominican scene, and it's definitely sort of Dominican kids around the world sort of talking to one another. Have we hit the point where any of this remix, any of the sort of global ghetto tech or whatever we're going to say, starts impacting sort of outside either the ethnic community or the specific musical community? Have we seen that sort of big crossover? Is that something you're sort of looking for? Or?
Yeah, that's there's a lot in there, and I want to try and pick a little bit of it apart. I mean, part of it is that, yes, what we're seeing performed here, for instance, is although it's in the Dominican Republic, it is sort of the New Yorkness of the Dominican Republic. I mean, likewise, on the other side of the coin, we might look at the Dominicanness of New York, which we can point to lots of different examples of. I think we also have to attend to what are they performing here? How is it read by a local audience, both by their peers as well as by older folk? And insofar as, you know, I'm trying to uphold this as an important part of the public conversation, public culture, and so forth, if you go to the YouTube videos for something like this, you see some very interesting and often contentious conversation about, oh, you're just aping Americans, you're just aping African Americans, you know, this is just conspicuous consumption, and your jeans are too tight, and, you know, what's happening to traditional Dominican masculinity, and that kind of thing. So they stage these interesting conversations. On the other hand, I don't know, for me, I look at this and do not see homogenization or cultural gray out or whatever. You know, I mean, what we see is, I mean, it's a locally accented version of a global thing, which in its own, you know, if we're talking about hip hop, was already a sort of product of multicultural New York, right? So, I mean, it does get again sort of naturalized as American or as African American, but it's more complicated than that still. As far as the question of, okay, when, how does this bleed out of these sort of immediate communities? Probably the best example of that is MIA, who I don't know, you know, she's won a Grammy, she's sold maybe millions of records. She's been sampled by big hip hop stars who have then sold millions of records. So there are ways in which there are certain people who are positioned in the right place, right? She's one of these uneasy peers. Yeah, she'll produce a song with a you know, that nods to funk carioca, that nods to other kinds of emerging, you know, international local dance genres, and yet she'll have access to the major media apparatus of the United States, so she's able to really capitalize it on it in a certain way, and then she's able in turn to be a reflection of that and to inform and inspire other kinds of directions. So, no, I think we're seeing that happen as well.
Other questions? We probably have time for one or two more. Sure.
This goes a little bit to what Ethan was bringing up. Has the circle turned? You have a commercial or a nonprofit thing like Playing for Change, where you have people collaborating around the world and actually making world music.
So I'm in Chicago, somebody else is in Dakar, somebody else is in Sri Lanka, so forth and so on.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if the circle has turned back on itself, do the new boys look at what the Dominican kids do and say, I want to work with them, or I want to riff off of what they did with riffing off of me? Are we getting some kind of cross-cultural collaboration, not just as an echo, but as actual collaboration between individuals or groups?
Yes, yeah, to some extent. I mean, it's That kind of thing I would describe as burgeoning. Still, a lot of what I see is more on the echo sort of level, right? That, you know, these kids, they get into, they go on YouTube and they search for jerkin, and then they see somebody doing a different dance move. So they search for that. They search for tectonique, and suddenly they're looking at videos from all over the Francophone world, you know? And then they fought, they find their way into Melbourne Shuffle, and they start to incorporate those moves. And so a lot more of it has to do with that, and the fact that once they're on YouTube, then there are these sort of serendipitous or random connections that that draw them into other places. As far as direct collaborations, there are some examples of it, but not a lot just yet. I mean, I expect there will be more. There are still problems, like basic problems that Global Voices thinks about all the time, like translation. I mean, to some extent, you can collaborate musically without needing to speak each other's language, and we've seen plenty of collaborations like that. Yeah, I guess I'd say a little bit right now. I'm having a hard time pulling a good example out of my head at the moment, but that, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in lots of ways, I think especially more often what you see is a collaboration between some kids like this and then some sort of savvier folk of an older generation who say, oh, I know how I can help you, you know, sort of bridge this commercial gap, bridge this audience gap, and maybe you want to mix some of this in what you do and that sort of thing. So that's happening too, but not always at exactly a peer-to-peer level.
I also wonder if the LA teenagers ever communicate to the Chicago teenagers.
Oh, yeah. No, sure, absolutely. In fact, just to show you that, this was, I think I got here from doing a search on his, yes. So here's another post on Dave Kwam's blog called "I Want to Learn How to Footwork," where he actually finds video of the New Boys going to Chicago and hearing all about Juke, and so getting into Juke. And Lil B is a rapper from California who also did some experimentation with Juke, in part because of traveling there, and in part because of finding it on the internet. So yeah, no, that's happening, absolutely. Thanks.
Last question. Anyone?
Sure.
Great.
Ben Weeks, I didn't get to introduce myself earlier, but I was wondering what you think kind of helps propagate this music style. Is it the dancing? Is it fashion? Or is it the actual music itself?
That's really hard to say. I mean, I do think that the fact that so much of this is dance music is a crucial part of it. I mean, the fact that it's embodied culture and the fact that you can watch somebody dance and then sort of see YouTube as a kind of mirror, right? That YouTube is the new, you know, you dance in front of the mirror. No, you dance in front of YouTube, right? And you learn those dances, and that's such a big part of it. I do think that's a part of it. I mean, I guess the music is as well. It's really hard to disambiguate these things in certain cases, because clearly the fashion is an important part as well. But is your question
I was just interested because the media encompasses all of these portions.
Right,
so
it's multimedia stuff. And yet, I mean, you know, I don't want to be sort of a musical imperialist about it, you know, as a musicologist or what have you. I do think that music is playing a sort of conspicuous, if not, you know, remarkable role in all of this. And I do think music has special properties that as Ethan and I were talking about in the Radio Berkman piece, that allow it to operate at a kind of cultural bleeding edge. And to sort of get its work its way out and be transformed in rapid ways that that other things maybe can't. So I do think there's something special about music, but I don't want to overstate that right now. Yeah, okay. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks very much.
Excellent talk.
Yeah. Great discussion.